John chapter 2, that's where we are. I saw something I wanted to, just a quick point, share with you from the news. You may have seen this. You may have seen the story, some of you at least. And this isn't anything extremely new. I've read this kind of thing, read about this kind of thing before, but it kind of struck me this time looking at it. It has to do with, I'll just read the first few lines of it. It says, North Carolina man has been charged with the murder in the case of two missing people, including Food Network star and contestant Christy Codd. And you may have heard that. I don't know if anybody watches the Food Network here. Maybe some of you do. And I didn't know who she was. Guess I don't watch the Food Network, really. But she tragically was murdered. And her husband as well, J.T. Codd, they were both murdered. And that's not why I'm reading this. I don't want to I don't want to act as if that's not a tragedy. It is. That's very much a tragedy on many levels, of course. Young woman, young man, and just murdered by somebody they knew. I think he was a neighbor of sorts, or he had done some work for them, construction work for them. But what struck me is that it goes on to say that she was 5 months pregnant with the couple's first child. And then it says, it talks about this fellow who committed this terrible crime. It says on Monday night, authorities were seen searching the home of 36-year-old Robert Jason Owens, who lived about a half mile from the Codds and was the couple's contractor. He was arrested the next day. Owens, and this is the thing that just kind of struck me, and Owens was charged with two counts of first-degree murder and one count of murder of an unborn child. I have heard of this kind of thing coming up before, but it just struck me as I read that here he's being charged with three murders because she was 5 months pregnant. Now, in most states, she could have an abortion if she wanted to. And so he's charged with the murder of her unborn child, but if she wanted to, and again, I know the tragedy here is that they lost their lives, and so I'm not making light of that. But if she hadn't lost her life and she chose to abort her child, even at five months in most states, you could still get an abortion. That's kind of complicated there, and it says here that although the vast majority of states restrict later term abortions, which there are laws in place, at a certain point you can no longer, I think it's between 20 and 24 weeks or so, then in most states they have a ban against abortions. But it says, it points that out, but it says many of these restrictions have been struck down. Most often courts have voided the limitations because they do not contain a health exception. So even in the states that put a restriction on the time there, that usually you can get around that. And I even read to where a lot of that is left up to the physician that you have. And if there's a lot of things that play, and I don't want to get into that too deeply, just to make it simple, you can at 5 months get an abortion. And in most states, you can work that out. And yet he's charged for murder on that, which he should have been. What shouldn't happen is the woman shouldn't be able to have an abortion ever. But isn't it ironic, even hypocritical, that they're charging him with murder, where if she wanted to, she could abort the child. That's not murder in their eyes. It's just something strange. Anyway, just caught my attention with that. And I've heard of things like that. I remember reading years ago, and turn over to John chapter 2. We'll get to that. But I remember hearing years ago see if I can get it straight because it has been so many years. You may have heard something like this too, of the woman who she was given a ticket. And in California, they have these lanes for, you know, when you're driving to work and you're, what do you call that, carpooling? They don't have that around here, do they? Do they? In California, they have a carpool lane. And what's wrong with Ohio? How come we don't have that? And the great state of California, you do have that. So you can get, if you carpool, there's a special lane. All that traffic is stalled. You can be in that lane. Well, this lady got a ticket, and she fought it because she was pregnant. And so she said, there's more than one. You have to have, the rule is you have to have more than one person in the car. And she won. So that's amazing. I'm surprised that they let that go, but she won that. So it all testifies to the fact that there is two individual lives involved in abortion. That's the point. All right, John chapter 2. We left off last week. We were talking about this first miracle that Jesus performed. Remember, he is just starting his personal ministry. And so that's, of course, an exciting time in history. You just reflect upon that, that God going all the way back to Genesis chapter 3, the same chapter where sin was introduced, God introduced the Savior, that Jesus would come, didn't call him by name, of course, but seed of woman would come and crush the devil. And so you have the first messianic prophecy in Genesis chapter 3. And all of that had to be worked out with the establishing of his people and the Messiah would come from that people and all of that. Now here we are that he's arrived and he has reached of age and he now begins his personal ministry. And so it's just getting started. And as we go through, of course, the book of John, we'll see that ministry in great detail. But we saw that. And so now in John chapter 2, he performs the very first miracle, or as John likes to call them, sign, that he has set forth, and we know what that is, the changing of water into wine. So, again, verse 1, on the third day there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what dost thou have to do with me? What does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." So that's where we left off last week. I was emphasizing that this is a mild rebuke that Jesus gives his mother, but it's not because he called her woman, as some people might think when they read that, but it's not by calling her mother. It's by emphasizing that she basically had no business in this affair that she was getting into. And we don't have the entire dialogue, and so obviously there was more said between them. But she clearly was wanting him to come forward and give a demonstration of who he really was. And so that's why he uses the language, and it's mild again, but it is a rebuke that he sets forth. What does this have to do with me? My hour is not yet come. And whenever you read through the Gospels, the hour of Jesus, it is always pointing to that time when he would be arrested and then, of course, die, be buried, and be raised from the dead, and be glorified, and God would be glorified in all of that. And that was his hour. And we see, look over at John chapter 7, and at verse 30, just to show you that. Here in John 7 at verse 30, it says, "And so they were seeking to arrest him," that is Jesus, "but no one laid a hand on him." Why? Because his hour had not yet come. So that's what he was pointing to, his hour. And we see that in John chapter 8 and at verse 20, it says in these words, "He spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple, but no one arrested him." Why? Because his hour had not yet come. And you just get out a concordance and look at that, and you'll see throughout that, just look up the word hour, and you'll see over and over, and all four of the gospel, the synoptics as well, that always points to that time when he would give his life on Calvary's cross, and then of course be raised from the dead, and that was the real evidence of who he was, and so that was his hour. Now there was a reason why Jesus then responded to her. She just simply asked for some help with the fact that they ran out of wine. And so, but he brings up, "My hour has not yet come," because he knows. Remember now, he's God. He's omniscient. He knows what's on the heart of his mother. He knows what she's really after. And what she's really after is a demonstration of who he is. Now, we'll see, even this sign that we'll be looking at, with this first miracle, is a manifestation of his messiahship. Every miracle that he performed demonstrated that he was who he said he was, but they're only secondary. the true demonstration of who he is was his death, burial, and resurrection. And that was always. In fact, later on in this chapter, you remember we'll get to here after a while, the cleansing of the temple and all of that. And after he does that, then the Pharisees ask for a sign. And that's when he talks about the destroying of his body and then the raising it up. Of course, he does so in terms of the temple, and they misunderstood him. But he's referring to his resurrection there, and that's the ultimate sign of who he is, that he is the Messiah. And so this is what Mary really is after. And he basically says, you know, you stay in your place. I have this my hour hasn't come, and I have nothing to do with that. She has nothing to do with that either. All right, verse 5 then, his mother said to the servants, and here's another aside, of course, you can't hardly pass up, do whatever he tells you. So again, we don't have the whole conversation, do we? He has indicated to her that he's going to resolve this situation, that he's going to help her. So she immediately tells the servants, do whatever he tells you. Now we know in the context what's going on here with regard to do whatever he says, but in principle, That's a statement that's applicable always, isn't it? That all of us should take heed to. And everybody in the world should take heed to. Whatever Jesus says, you do it. And certainly that's where true Christianity is. When we develop that kind of mindset, whatever he says, I'm going to do. And if we can live by that principle, we'd all be great, great Christians. And that's exactly what God expects. He doesn't expect anything less than that. Whatever, of course, you know, Jesus now speaks to us through his word, but through his word, whatever you read, do it. Doesn't matter if you like it or not. It doesn't matter how much you have to sacrifice or suffer. Whatever Jesus tells you to do, just do it. And you can imagine how that would be transforming as a congregation, that if every congregation did that, the cause of Christ would thrive everywhere. Because that's the attitude certainly that we ought to have. And someone has made the point with all of this. And again, this is just kind of an aside. We'll get to the real happenings here with the turning of water into wine. But someone has made the point, and I think it just makes for a great teaching and preaching point, that Jesus, he's no longer changing or transforming water into wine. He's never going to do that again. But he's still in the business of transforming lives. And whenever he does that, the life, just like the wine, ends up better. We'll find when we get into that, that the wine that he makes is good. And so it was better than the wine that ran out. And that's the way it is with our lives. When we let him transform our lives, he can, maybe you're a wishy-washy Christian, he can transform you into being a committed, fully active child of God. Or maybe you're a bad spouse. He can transform you into being a good spouse. Or if you're a good spouse, a great spouse. Or whatever application you want to make of that, Jesus is still in the business of changing lives. And it's sort of edifying just to stop and think about, just look on the pages of inspiration of how many lives have truly been changed because they allow Jesus, through the gospel of Christ, to do that. You think of the Corinthians. We think in negative terms of the Corinthians. Remember though, of course, most of you do, over in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, the past that they had. Sometimes you forget how transformed they became. 1 Corinthians 6 and at verse 9, or do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived, neither the sexual immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor men who practice homosexuality, nor thieves, nor the greedy, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor swindlers will inherit the kingdom of God. Now watch, verse 11, and such were some of you, but you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and by the Spirit of our God. When did all that happen? When they obeyed the gospel. Jesus transformed them through the gospel of Christ. And I mean, that's quite a list, isn't it? When you stop and think about that, they were drunkards and homosexuals, adulterers and guilty of idolatry and all of that. and the powerful gospel of Christ changed them. I know they were having some problems, and this is, Paul writes a very stern letter to them, but their lives had been transformed. And I think about that. I think about the brethren at Thessalonica, where Paul, you remember, in 1 Thessalonians said, you've turned from idols to serve the true and living God. And most of you know, when you're involved in idolatry in those societies and those cultures, there was all kind of immorality involved in that. Most of them had sexual involvement in that. It was a part of it. Sex was a part of their religion. And so someone who's involved in idolatry, you can just almost guarantee they were involved in what we would believe to be, and the Bible standard would say, was immoral living. But they left that behind to serve the true and living God. They were transformed. Their lives changed completely. And I tell you about Paul, he was a blasphemer, according to his own words, and a murderer. And yet he became a great apostle because he received the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so Jesus is in the transforming business, but we have to allow that to happen. Even those of us, again, who are Christians, we can all improve, can't we? And not a person here in this auditorium who doesn't have room of improvement. Areas where you can be a better Christian. And Jesus can do that, can help you to be that better Christian. But we have to allow him to do that. There's something for us to do, even as we go back to John chapter 2, even as we think about this miracle, there was something. If that water was going to be changed into wine, there was something for the people there to do. And there's always an example that there are things for us to do if we want to be transformed by the gospel of Christ. But anyway, just a good statement there that makes for, again, good teaching and preaching. Do whatever he tells you. We need to make application of that. Now, there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rite of purification. Of course, they had to wash their hands before they ate and that sort of thing. That was one of the tradition of the elders. Wasn't a part of the law of Moses, but they had that kind of thing. And other purification rites that they had. So they had the jars there. And he says, fill them with water. And notice that. Now, this is important. It first of all mentions that there were 20 or 30 gallons in these jars. Now, you do the adding. That means that there was over 100 gallons of water, maybe closer to 200 gallons. And so when those jars are filled to the brim and they're all turned to wine, is that a little bit or a lot of wine? That's quite a bit of wine. So now you're talking about over 100, probably again closer to 200 gallons of wine that's produced. So kind of think about that. Keep that in your mind as we go forward with that. But Jesus says, fill the jars with water. And they knew what he meant by that. They filled them up to the brim. That's what Jesus was after. He wanted them to fill them up. Why would it be important to fill the jars up instead of, maybe halfway or three quarters? Why do you have to fill it up? Very good. That's exactly right. There'd be no denying. If they didn't fill it all the way up, someone could have come back and said, oh, someone just slipped in after him and poured some wine in there. But no, they filled it up all the way to the top, to the brim. So there's no trickery. Nobody can claim that Jesus faked this or his disciples helped him to fake it or anything like that. They filled him up. That's what he wanted. That's what they did. They filled it to the brim. And he said to them, now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast. So they took it. And when the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine. And that's interesting to me that in light of all of the kind of things that happen go on in the religious world today, Jesus just changed the wine. There was no fanfare. He didn't have to speak any words or anything like that. He didn't have to draw any kind of real attention to himself or anything like that. He just, bam, just did it. He basically just thought it was done. And that's the real power of God. And so they just fill him up, and now it's done. The water has been changed into wine. And so they take it to the master of the feast. And when the master of the feast tasted the water now become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom because he wants to praise them. He wants to praise the bridegroom. Why? Verse 10 tells us. It said, and he said to him, everyone serves good wine first. And when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now. And so I want you to keep that in mind. This wine is good wine. And that's important in understanding what kind of wine is under consideration here. But it was good wine. I said verse 11, this is the first sign, the first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. And so it had the effect that, of course, it was meant to have. In this case, it helped to build the faith of his disciples. And certainly, again, that's the reason for the miracles. All right, the burning question then is, what kind of wine did Jesus make on this occasion? And there's been a lot said about this wine, and a lot of people have tried to justify social drinking on the basis of this wine, and certainly that can't do. That won't do. This passage doesn't give any authority for social drinking at all. In fact, social drinking is straightly condemned in the Word of God. But what kind of wine was this? Was it fermented wine or unfermented wine? And there's always a few things to point out with regard to this particular passage. And that is, the first one is that the word wine, the Greek word here is oinos. And it always, it's used, it's the same word no matter how it's used. Sometimes it's used with regard to fermented wine. Sometimes it's used in regard to unfermented wine. Sometimes it's used even to describe the juice when it's still in the grape. But it's always the same word. And the point of it is then, you can't just look at a passage like this and assume, well, he turned water into wine. It had to be the kind of wine to get people drunk. It had to be fermented wine. No, you don't know that just by looking. It's the same thing in the Old Testament. Yayin is the Hebrew word, and same thing. Same word used with fermented wine, unfermented wine, and then wine that is in the cluster still in the grape. So whether it's Old Testament or New Testament, you read the word wine in order to find out what kind of wine it is, what kind of power or strength it had, you have to read the context. It's the only way you can discover it, not just by seeing the word wine. So that's the first thing to point out. Second of all, as you stop and just think about this word good that I was emphasizing a while ago, that in using this context kind of gives us a clue as to what kind of wine it was. And we wouldn't think that because today when someone talks about some kind of drink being good, particularly when they're talking about alcoholic drink, a lot of people would associate the strength of the drink with the word good. But in biblical times, it was the very opposite. Good wine was wine that had no strength. The best wine was, from the standpoint of the ability to intoxicate, the weakest wine. And Barnes quotes several people from that era. Pliny was a Roman scholar. He emphasizes, in fact, in one place he said that good wine is destitute of spirit. And Plutarch was another Greek moralist who did a lot of writing on moral things, and some of his writings made reference to the fact that what we're talking about now, that good wine was wine that had little strength to it. And so if the description of the wine in John 2 was going to lead us in one direction or the other, is this fermented or unfermented? Just the term good itself would lead us into the direction that it was unfermented. It was destitute of spirit. At least that's how the word was used in connection with wine throughout that particular period of time. And then, as I just stop and consider, was this wine fermented? Well, for me, I have to just stop and think about Jesus himself. And again, remember, in this passage, you can't just look at the word wine and come to any conclusion about that. There's many passages where it's not. In fact, look over at Matthew chapter 9 at verse 17. Just give you, I should have read this earlier. But Matthew chapter 9, here's an example of what I was talking about before. Here's one passage where the word wine is used with regard to fermented wine and unfermented wine. Verse 17 says, neither is new wine put into old wineskins. Now, new wine would be wine that was freshly pressed. It would not be fermented. It would be new. It would be just out of the cluster. And so you don't take that kind of wine and put it into old wineskins. Why? Because the wineskins wouldn't have the ability to preserve it. It would ferment and expand, and then it would cause the old skins to burst. See, so you'd only put new wine into new wineskins. And it's the point that he's making there. So the word wine there, verse 17, is clearly being used with regard to unfermented wine. It's new wine. It would eventually ferment, and then it would bust the, if you put it in old skins, it says, if it is, the skins will burst and the wine is spilled. Now, that wine that now causes these old skins to burst, what condition is that wine in? And now it's fermented, see. But it's oinos. It's the same word used like that. So the point of it is, you just can't tell just by the word itself. Neither can we just by the word in John chapter 2. So you have to start looking at context. And the first clue is the word good gives us some information. But the second one, and maybe the most important one, is just the very character of Jesus himself. Remember what we said a while ago? How many gallons of water were there? Over 100? As much as 200? Do you think Jesus would provide that much intoxicating drink for an occasion like this? He would be promoting intoxication. And look over at Proverbs chapter 23. In Proverbs chapter 23, remember, of course, Jesus is the Son of God, and he knows the Scriptures better than anyone. And so as we think about this passage, you've read this passage, I'm sure, before. But notice what it says about intoxicating drink. Proverbs 23, and at verse 31, it says, do not look at wine when it is red. Now, that obviously, in the context, you'll see, obviously is referring to wine that has strength to it, that intoxicates, that has been fermented. And do you think Jesus was aware of this passage in Proverbs 23? Look not, it says, on the wine when it is red. When it sparkles in its cup. Now watch this. And goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. Your eyes will see strange things and your heart utter perverse things. You will be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, like the one who lies on top of the mast. They struck me, you will say, but I did not hurt. They beat me and I didn't feel it. What does that sound like? When should I wake? When should I wake? I must have another drink. That's describing a drunk person, isn't it? Been hit, but you don't feel it? That's a person who's intoxicated. Why? Because he drank the wine when it was red. He drank the intoxicating drink. But here's a passage that says, don't look at it. It's just a proverb, I know. But still, here's a verse in the Word of God that said, don't look at the wine when it is red. And Do you think Jesus knew of that passage? And yet, would you conclude that still he made almost 200 gallons of red wine, intoxicating wine, for people to not only look upon, but to obviously partake of? No, I lean against that strongly. And something to consider, too. You've probably heard me make this point before, that with regard to wine, just in general, strong drink in the Bible is always condemned. Strong drink is referenced 23 times in the Old Testament. And 21 of those times, it is straight out condemned. Twice, it's not condemned specifically, but in one passage, it is dealing with a drink offering, using it as a drink offering. In the other passage, it just talks about not drinking the strong drink, but buying it. And now you think, well, if the Bible gives it okay to buy strong drink, then you must be able to drink. Well, not necessarily. I just said one of the passages, the strong drink is used for a drink offering. So you could, I mean, you had to, if you're going to offer a drink offering, you had to get that strong drink somewhere to offer. That was the kind of drink. I think it's actually referred to as strong wine in that connection. But anyway, you had to use that for the offering. So, but those are only two passages, and 21 of the 23 is just straight out condemned. Strong drink is condemned in the Bible, period. And I've often made the point, just for those who think that social drinking is okay, that the fact of the matter is, back in those days, and I don't have on the top of my head all the numbers to this, but back in those days, they always added water to the wine. Because, again, the less powerful, the less strength it had, the better it tasted is what they considered to be good. So it was always cut with water. And again, I don't remember the numbers, but it was, in many cases, like 10 parts water, one part wine. I mean, it was weak stuff. Even the intoxicating drink that people would drink, it was weak stuff. And I've often made the point, you cannot buy, I guarantee you, you can't go in any store today. You can't go in any grocery store, liquor store, whatever, and find drink that wouldn't be considered, from a biblical measure, strong drink. Anything you get off of any shelf in any store would be strong drink. And the Bible condemns strong drink. And so you ought to think about that, just in the overall position of whether or not you ought to drink, whether or not social drinking. This is really a different issue than social drinking. Social drinking, there's no doubt, as Christians, we should not be out there among people drinking for a lot of different reasons. But even stop and consider the idea of strong drink itself, and whether or not the kind of alcohol that we have in this country that you buy, and the things that go into it, and the alcoholic level, all of that, is that the kind of thing that we want to be associated with? I don't hesitate to say no. Yes. Absolutely, absolutely. And so we're kind of dealing with two things here. You know, I mean, I think in my mind, the issue is settled with regard to John 2. If you're going to justify social drinking, you're not going to do it by John 2, because you couldn't prove your life depended on it, that Jesus turned that water into intoxicating wine. But just the overall idea of alcohol, and the damage that it does in society, and the lives that have been lost, families that have been ruined. As Christians, we should want to associate with something of that nature. If it's nothing more than, well, I like it. Well, you, there are a lot of kind of drinks that you probably can like. So drink something else. You don't have to be associated with that. But for sure, Jesus, and I've often made the argument, you've heard me again, I've preached on this before, in Ephesians 5 at verse 18, where the word drunk is used, that methusko is the Greek word there, and Vines at least, and I think Thayer as well, both of them, who were pretty reliable scholars on Greek words, they emphasize, both of them, that there's a slight distinction. It is slight, but there is a distinction between methusko and methuo. Methuo means to be intoxicated, to be drunk. Methusko, which you find in Ephesians 5:18, is dealing with the process of getting drunk, being made drunk. And that is slight, but there is a difference. What Paul really condemns in Ephesians 5 at verse 18 is the process of getting drunk. So I've often raised the question, when in the world does that process begin? And I don't know. And I don't care because I don't drink. But if you do drink, you better stop and think about that. Because that is straightly condemned. Is it one drink? Have you started the process? Are you absolutely sure you haven't started the process? If you decide to socially drink or to drink even a little bit, you need to honestly answer that question for yourself. But the process, it's not just being drunk that's condemned in the Bible. The process of getting drunk is condemned in Ephesians 5:18. Yes, Steve.
I was going to say, quite a few places refer to new wine even as intoxicating. Like in Acts 2, they thought that the apostles were filled with new wine.
Yes. They didn't have, now, it is wrong to conclude, and I'm not an expert on this at all. Some brethren are. They didn't have the same ability to preserve wine like we did. So it became pretty intoxicated. So you're right about that. There's a situation where it's going to ferment. Now, I've had some brethren argue, and I don't even know why brethren would want to argue this, to be honest with you. But there are some brethren I've had brethren in a Bible class like this argue that it was impossible to preserve wine in the Old Testament, and that has just been proven to be wrong. I know of at least one preacher who has done it, who went so far, he wanted to be able to say that that's wrong, to the point, he was a very smart guy, that he set up the system where you could preserve wine like they would have done in the Old Testament, and proved it to himself, and now he can teach it and preach it pretty strongly. But the fact of the matter is, you know, some people make that argument. You couldn't preserve it, and therefore, any wine you ever read about in the Bible was always intoxicating. That's just not true. That's just not true. The context tells the story. And you'd just be hard-pressed to convince me that Jesus, in this case, turned the water into something that would intoxicate and get people drunk. And why would we want to be associated with it even? You know, there's some recipes that call for alcoholic things that, well, I like to make that recipe, but I can't get myself to buy a little wine in the grocery store. Yeah, go ahead, and then time's up, so we'll go ahead and close. Yeah, go ahead. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, good point. Very, very good. That's a good point. All right, appreciate your attention. We'll pick up there next week.